If after these services are completed, you would go to our beautiful chapel and examine there the magnificent stained windows which sparkle along its exterior, you will notice in this stained glass portrayed many of the significant and sacred rituals, objects, and memorial objects of our people. In several of the windows, you will see a small 5- or 6-stringed harp surmounted by a royal crown. The crown is David's, and the harp is King David's. For by our tradition, King David played on this harp, but accompanied and composed many of the beautiful poems and hymns which feature our Book of Psalms. Indeed, it was music, his ability with the harp, which first brought David into national prominence. King Saul, Israel's first ruler, was subject to periodic fits of extreme depression and melancholia. There were no psychiatrists in that day to consult, but the advisors of the king knew that music hath charms which soothes the savage breast. And they advised their ruler to bring into his court, to his entourage, someone who would have been called in other times a troubadour or a minor singer, a man who could play some beautiful instrument and sing to the king and bring the king slowly but surely out of his tension and depression. Now David, apparently, though young and though only a farm lad, had such a reputation. His reputation earned him a recommendation and an interview. He found favor in the sight of Saul. And when he did play for the king, the Bible tells us, when the evil spirit came again upon Saul, David played for him, and his anger was assuaged, and the evil spirit departed from him. Now, all was not tranquil and beautiful in the relations between Saul and David. Even while David continued as Saul's personal musician, Saul's anger would sometimes get the better of him, and the Bible records at least one instance in which an enraged king took up the spear lying beside his bed and hurled it at the head of his musician. David apparently was born to good fortune. He was comely, he was able, he somehow had the knack, the ability to be at the right place at the right time. And his growing fame and charm soon came in Saul's eyes to be a rival to his own. And Saul's anger grew into hatred. He drove the young David from his court. And David was a refugee in exile for many years. Now when Saul one day met in battle the ancient enemy of the Jews, the Philistines, on Mount Gilboa, his troops were defeated. And both Saul and his young, proud, princely son, Jonathan, died as a result of that battle. David, hearing of this, of the death of his ancient enemy, and yet benefactor, and of his son, who was his closest friend, composed one of the most beautiful laments or elegies known to any language, an elegy which still has the power to move it. And in this elegy, I think we can see a bit of the reason that David is called Ne'im Zemirot Yisrael, the sweet singer of Israel. Thy beauty, O Israel, upon thy high places is slain. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Saul and Jonathan, the lovely and the pleasant in their lives, even in their death, they are not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet, who gave you all manner of delight, who put ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan upon thy high places is slain. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Wonderful was thy love unto me, surpassing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war have perished. David's reputation as a psalmist, as a poet, as a man who could sing the beautiful melodies of his people, gave him legendarily the title of the patron saint of all of Jewish poetry. And tradition ascribed to King David the authorship of the 150 poems or hymns which comprise our Book of Psalms. Actually, in the various subtitles which are given to these psalms in the book itself, only 73 of these are called by his name. And modern scholarship has shown to us that most of these refer to historical events and happenings in Jewish history which long succeeded the death of the king. Nevertheless, the role of David in the development of the poetic genius of our people cannot be underestimated. He raised poetry to a new stature, to a new rank among the people. It became a noble art, much sought after. And it's probably he who developed the unique, metrical, accentuated, rhythmical genre of writing, which became the basic format of all of the Psalms and of the other poems which sprinkle our Bible. Certainly, David tapped a rich ore of creative genius in the Jewish people. For the 150 Psalms which compose this Psalter are among the most unique, well-conceived, and moving collection or anthology of poems that have ever been devised. They are familiar to us because the Psalms are probably the most familiar book of our Bible. They are the basic substructure of our prayer service. Many of the phrases from the book of Psalms have become popular idioms in our language. We have only to think of such phrases as, "Wine maketh glad the heart of man. The days of our years are 70 years, or even by reason of strength, 80 years. They that seed in sorrow shall reap in joy. The stone which the builders have rejected has become the chief cornerstone." We might add to this list indefinitely. The man who collected these these Psalms is unknown to us. He lived in the 3rd or 4th centuries before the Common Era, and either individually or as a member of some editing committee, brought into this volume the cream of Jewish poetry which had been developed in the 7 preceding centuries. Most of the authors of the Psalms are equally anonymous. We know a few by name. Some 12 or 13 are called, written by the B'nai Korach, the sons of Korach, who were apparently a guild of professional writers of hymns and psalms for the synagogue. Now, there are basically two types of poems which are contained in the Book of Psalms. The first is a highly personal lyric poem, which expresses the inner turmoil, the emotions of an individual, highly sensitive to the stresses and strains, the hopes and the fears, the discomforts and the triumphs which surround him in life. And this strain in the Book of Psalms is particularly important in the development of world literature because it represents in history the first development of a personal poetry. Until the days of the Psalms, almost all poetry was universal, directed to a group, written for a service or for a prayer ritual or for some ruling monarch. It had none of that richly subjective quality which has become so dear to the poets of our Western civilization. And the second type of poetry is a poetry of the community, of the group. Poetry generally written expressly for the synagogue service, as prayers to accompany the sacrifice, as songs to accompany the ritual. These prayers express the basic hopes and aspirations and needs and faith of the Jewish people. And they continue to express the basic needs and hopes of the Jewish people and of all peoples. because they partake richly and deeply of the universal quality of human experience. Let me illustrate these two types of poems by two which were written about precisely the same occurrence in Jewish history. David conquered Jerusalem and established it as the capital of the Jewish state. Some four centuries later, the Jewish state was overrun. The capital was destroyed, the temple was desecrated and razed to the ground, and the nobility of the Jewish people were led away captive by Nebuchadnezzar, emperor of the Babylonians, czar of the whole of the Middle East. In the year 586, this exile began. It lasted for a half century and more. And in this exile, the Jewish people developed some of the most important of the institutions which feature life for us today. Here was born the synagogue. Here was born the institution of the rabbinate. Here was born the dream of a democratic type of faith. But the people dreamt in their exile of returning to their homeland, reestablishing the temple ritual, the festival and daily services which took place there. And two of these poems of bittersweet longing have been left to us. The first, which I should like to read to you, is the feelings of an individual captive. And the last is a man who synthesizes the feelings of the group. As the heart pants after the water brooks, so pants my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before him? My tears have been my food day and night, while they say unto me all the day, where is thy God? Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why moanest thou within me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him, for salvation is of his doing. And then the poet who synthesizes the feelings of many men who must have felt as the author of the 42nd Psalm, which I just read to you. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst thereof, we hung our harps. They that led us captive asked of us words of song. Our tormentors demanded of us verse, saying, sing to us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I remember thee not, if I set not Jerusalem above my chiefest joy. Now, poems such as the 137th Psalm, which I just read to you, were incorporated early and may have been written expressly for the service of the synagogue and of the temple. There were in the temple, besides the Kohanim, the priests who performed the actual sacrifices and made the decisions of policy, a group of ministrants known as Levites, or Levim. And among these Levites, there were professional guilds of musicians and of singers, a chorus, who accompanied all the festival and daily rituals and sacrifices of our people. We have still in the superscription of many of the Psalms specific instructions to the director of the temple orchestra. Thus, for instance, the sixth Psalm tells us that it is a psalm for stringed instruments, which is to be developed, the theme of which is to be developed, especially an instrument called the shminit, which apparently was a type of simple viola, which had eight strings. Sometimes the superscription tells us even the key in which the psalms themselves were to be sung. We get an indication of the use of the psalms in the temple worship from the familiar 118th Psalm. And we can see here how the solo voice gave out to the people the key phrase, and the people would return a well-known chorus, so that you would have, as you do still in the Arab world in the Near East, the call of the cry of the muezzin from his high pulpit and the response of the people as a congregation. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, went out the call, and the response, for his mercy endureth forever. So let the house of Israel now say, for his mercy endureth forever. So let the sons of Aaron now say, for his mercy endureth forever. So let them now that revere the Lord say, for his mercy endureth forever. And we have taken this Hodu Ladonoi Ki Tov Ki Leolam Hasdo, and we have used it as part of the beautiful Seder ritual. And you will hear it in several months here at the temple. We still use it in much the same form in which it was used in those days. It is interesting to note, when we consider the Book of Psalms, that it is the one book of the Bible which is ever published by itself. And I'm told that editions of the Psalter, of just these 150 poems, sell well over 100,000 of copies every year. If we look for the reason for the popularity of this book, I think we will find that its familiarity is one. And the second reason is in the unique quality which it possesses, which I have called the quality of gentleness. When the cares of the world wash over us at night, or when we are troubled in our hearts, in our conscience, by loss or illness, or when we are faced by an obstacle along the path of life which seems too much for us to overleap, or when we are enjoying some moment of elation, some triumph which we wish to share and fully to appreciate, somehow by turning to the Book of Psalms and sharing there the experience of others who with us have experienced these universal human emotions, we find a gentle refreshment of the soul, a new perspective on our individual situation, new hope, new faith, and new comfort. The Bible speaks with many tongues, and it speaks to us in many colors. The five books of Moses speak to us in terms of basic religious affirmations. It appeals to our mind and asks us, as it tells us, the great legends and law of our people, to exercise our mental powers to understand the fundamental principles on which our faith is based. The prophets disturb us. They challenge us. They command us. They order us out of our lethargy, out of our indolence, out of our self-concern into a new way of life. One more moral, more unselfish, more determined to secure the welfare of the community and of the world. There is an insistent quality, which is emotionally disturbing, but healthy for the soul, in the books of the prophets. The Psalms speak to us gently. They lead us by the hand along the way of life. Where the prophets we might speak of as masculine, as disciplinarian, as authoritarian, the prophets are our, the Psalms are our loving mother, who shelters us a bit from the strains of life, who leads us by the hand through the various difficulties which confront us. The Gideon Society in America has made the most of this gentle quality of the Book of Psalms. I'm sure that you all know of their national program, which places a Bible in every hotel room and in most of the public buildings of our country. And if you have ever opened this Bible, which is the standard King James Version, you'll find that it is unique in only one thing, and that inside the front cover, there has been glued a sheet of printed paper on which are listed the various human moods which we all partake, and suggested readings which can help us solve these particular tensions and problems. Most of these readings, you will notice, are from the Book of Psalms. And though some of us might wonder at the choices which the Gideons have made, their basic idea was sound. Because those who make it a policy of reading the Bible will tell you that in moments of stress and moments of loss, moments of tension and moments of anxiety, they have found great comfort and great sustenance by reading these magnificent soul poems. It is no happenstance that we of the synagogue choose the 23rd Psalm to read at times of mourning. For who then has not need of its quiet, gentle, and reassuring faith? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in the green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in straight paths for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou, O Lord, art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou hast anointed my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And there's another psalm, the 130th psalm, which has always to me brought comfort, brought this reassurance that dawn will follow the dark, that light will yet break in on my troubles. Out of the depths have I called thee, O Lord. Lord, hearken unto my voice. Let thine ear be attentive to the voice of my supplications. If thou, O Lord, shouldest mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? For with thee there is forgiveness that thou mayest be revered. I wait for the Lord. My soul doth wait, and in his word do I hope. My soul waiteth for the Lord more than the watchman for the morning, more than the watchman for the morning. O Israel, hope thou in the Lord. For with the Lord there is mercy, and with him is plenteous redemption. And he will redeem Israel from all of his iniquities. We need this gentle quality in our religious belief. Life is not easy. We cannot always bring to the temple in terms of service, in terms of participation, more than we take from it. We need sometimes the ear which it gives us to listen to our troubles, the hand which it lends us to guide us and sustain us along the slippery ways of life, the advice which it has for us to tide us through the times of evil and ill. Religion needs this quality of gentleness. It needs to bring comfort to the mourner, encouragement to the infirm and to the ill, gentle learning to the young, hope to those who are racked by tension in marriage or in their family lives. And religion has a great burden of comfort to give through the Bible and more personally through its teachers and teachings to those who will make of this available to them. And we need also to complement the tenderness which God promises us with the tenderness which we show, the gentleness which we show to our fellow man. The Overstreets once said that no marriage can long succeed unless both the man and the wife are gentle to one another. Unless they are slow to anger, quick to forgive, and willing to live with the inadequacies of the other, and willing to sustain indefinitely, eternally, the other along the ways of life. A love which they said must know how to share, and how to sustain, and how to sacrifice. And this is gentle love, the quality of gentleness which we need in all of our human relationships. We need to be slow to anger, not to take offense at assumed indignities to our person, not to return sarcasm for sarcasm, bitterness for bitterness, ill for ill. We need, if we are gentle people, to absorb more of the unhappiness of the world than we send out and transmit to the world. And it is one of the tragedies of modern living that the instinctive gentleness of our young we attempt to destroy. We train it out of them. Or at least we tell them that only certain areas of life has gentleness a place. It is a truism of modern economics that the heart has no place in business. We teach our young that in the economic world, it is a dog-eat-dog world, and they should worry about themselves and not so much about the other person. And even our charity has become so organized that the individual generosity is separated from the generous response of the one who receives, and we have not even that outlet for our young to sense the worthwhileness of gentleness. I read recently, or it was shown recently, a lead article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal. It discussed the most economic and feasible means of pensioning or otherwise ridding the company of veteran employees who had not yet reached the retirement age, but who had become a burden to a new management or new policies. And as I read this hard-headed, realistic article, I could not help but think that no gentleman could be concerned with these terms. He weighs equally the dollar sign and the human person. He knows of the personality needs of this veteran person working with him. He plans for his future as much as for the future of the company which he is running. He finds some means in achieving both goals rather than simply setting the one goal, business success, as preeminent and forgetting the human values of the employees and the people who work for him and with him. We desperately need in our world a nascent, burgeoning quality of gentleness in all of our human relationships, to our friends, to our family, and to our community. But it is well to remember that the chord which is struck by the Book of Psalms is only one of the many chords which comprise the symphony of the Bible. You need firmness as well as gentleness in life. We have seen this in our families in recent years, where those parents who allowed complete permissiveness in their home, that which they misunderstood as gentleness, found that the young people were being raised without any sense of purpose, of order, any series of set of values onto which they could fall back. Permissiveness, timidity, is not the opposite of authority. We need to combine a sense of purpose, which is the firmness of the prophets, the thou shalt and the thou shalt nots of the Ten Commandments, with the gentleness of the heart, with the gentleness of the soul and of the spirit. When we do, we shall be blending in our lives a truly worthwhile mixture of motives and be leading lives worthy of being called mature. There has been recently in America an increasing voice given to those who claim that religion should be concerned only with the type of message which is revealed by the Book of Psalms. Religion is healing. Religion is love. Religion is mental health. The minister must be principally the pastor. I even read recently an article in one of the leading Protestant journals where it was seriously proposed that the sermon disappear from the Protestant service. The author wrote, "We come to the service to commune with God, to pray, and to forget." To forget. We come to the service to pray, to commune with God, and to remember. Because a religion which tries only to comfort and to counsel, and to bring happiness through those forms, will find it will bring increased unhappiness if it does not come to grips with the social and moral problems of the everyday life. It does not help its people to solve these. A rabbi spoke of two tendencies in Jewish life. One is to speak divrei tochacha, the other divrei tanchumim, the words of consolation and the words of challenge. We must continue to preach both, to have the institutions of which we are a part and which we represent speak and teach both, and to be willing to search for both from our pulpit and from our preachers. We must come to grips with the challenges of our daily life, and we must be willing to listen to those who tell us when we have failed to live up to these challenges. But we must be also willing to seek from them personal help when it is needed, comfort and faith, gentleness and firmness. These are the two poles within which Jewish life moves. May it continue to preach and teach both of these intelligently through the years ahead. Amen.